The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And this is one I am super excited about. The winemaker, the vision behind Bonnie Doon Vineyards, one of the original Rhone Rangers. It is Randall Graham. Randall, thank you so much for doing the podcast.
Piacere.
So I first ran into your wines by mistake. I was at the Royal York Hotel in Toronto for the Wines of California, and it was packed, and everyone's lining up to try Silver Oak, and everyone's lining up to try some Cabernet Sauvignon. And then there's one little booth with your guys' wine, and I remember this so well. I remember trying a couple, and I stopped everything I was doing. I'm like, what the hell is going on? Why is this so good? Who is this? Where can I get all of their wine? Unfortunately, can't get much in Toronto. But Randall, that's how I first found out about Bonnie Doon Wines, was just by a pure mistake, probably about 7 years ago.
Oh, that recently.
Yep.
Yes. Yeah, it's been the distribution in Ontario has been spotty, alas.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It's
hoping to fix that pretty soon, or it's being fixed as we speak.
I hope so, because I'll check the different consignment companies, because your wines, your vision is something that I think pretty much people in Ontario should know more about. But before I get to the vision, I'm getting ahead of myself. I was wondering if you could first just tell people, and I'm sorry, I know you've told these stories. How did you go from working a low-level job at a wine retailer in Beverly Hills to founding Bonnie Doon Vineyards in like 1983?
Oh my gosh. Well, I was very lucky. I had very supportive parents who were very generous and helped me get started. They bought some land in the eponymous hamlet of Bonnie Doon, California, in the Santa Cruz Mountains, planted Pinot Noir, which turned out to be a mistake, but a happy mistake. Because it ultimately, the fact that it wasn't working, the fact that I was able to figure out early enough in my career that it wasn't going to work very well, compelled me to discover Rhone varieties, again, rather by accident. And that was a very felicitous discovery, indeed.
What was your parents' vision for their son before you went into wine? Did they have a particular journey they were hoping from you?
Not wine, for sure. I mean, they were hoping that I would go to medical school and become a doctor. Of course, I couldn't stand the sight of blood, but this was not a great path for me. And as it turns out, I have many doctor friends, and all of them want to be winemakers. I think I just saved myself one step, like a 20-year detour, for sure.
But you could tell them, listen, the amount of science, geography, geology. I mean, you might not have become a doctor, but you certainly are someone who has to know a lot about science.
Yeah, I mean, I went as far as finishing the whole pre-med curriculum.
Really?
I had incorporated my parents' wishes and desire to please them. I was on my way. But this is one of the reasons it took me forever to finish school, as I majored in like six different things. Went to college essentially twice. So it was a long journey.
So what failed with you with Pinot? Before we get to Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre, and all of that, what was it about Pinot that didn't work?
Well, it wasn't sublime. I mean, the reason Pinot works, and I should say, Pinot is one thing to make good Pinot Noir. I wasn't interested in making good Pinot Noir. I was interested in making great Pinot Noir. I was interested in making sublime Pinot Noir. But the point is, what's interesting about Pinot Noir is mostly interesting when it's grown in Burgundy, when it's exquisitely tuned to the site where it belongs. And the point is, I still don't believe that I have anything truly original to contribute to the world's understanding about Pinot Noir. If I felt I could improve upon Burgundy, if I felt I could do something truly distinctive, I mean, at this point in my career, I'm not interested in making pretty good wine. I'm interested in doing something utterly distinctive and helpful to the conversation. So I believe now that I just don't really have much to say, or that we in the New World really have much to say by trying to emulate old world styles. I think it's just kind of, it's imitative and it's kind of beside the point. I mean, you're making an interesting facsimile at best. That's not so interesting.
Yeah, and it's funny. You go to any winery anywhere in the world, and they always say, we do ours Burgundian style. I remember every time in Napa, every place, oh, yes, we do ours Burgundian. I'm like, no, you don't. You do yours Russian River Valley. You just say you do it. You can't do it Burgundian because you're not in Burgundy.
Correct. And ultimately, it turns out that to make wine in a truly, if you will, Burgundian style, it is far more expensive to do it in the New World than it is in Burgundy. It's just a lot easier to just buy all the Burgundy you ever could possibly want to drink. That's a much more efficient way of keeping yourself in Burgundy.
Is there anywhere in the New World that you appreciate Pinot Noir beyond, obviously, France?
Well, I mean, I appreciate the brilliance of the copy. You know, there's a wonderful Borges story about a short story where an author, a modern day author, tries to replicate writing Don Quixote, Cervantes' Don Quixote, and he basically rewrites Quixote word for word. I mean, and Borges says, kind of ironically, you know, in reading this sort of new version of Quixote, it's so more deeply inspiring than the old. Of course, it's exactly the same text, but just knowing that what went into it. And so in a sense, it's very impressive to see people who are able to copy Burgundy, but at the end of the day, it's a copy and
yeah,
not so interesting. I mean, to answer your question, I think New Zealand Pinot Noirs can be very, very nice. Oregon Pinot Noir is quite nice. Even some California, and I'm told there's some pretty good ones in Ontario. I that's what I've been told.
If you ever get a chance, Prince Edward County, Prince Edward County, there's some really good Pinot Noir. There's some good stuff in Niagara as well. I prefer the Cab Francs, the Gamays, but there are some good Pinots in Niagara region, but Prince Edward County, really they've got a good thing going there. So what it's funny, this podcast, the hardcore wine people, they're going to know most of this already because people need to know, listen to this, like that Randall Graham is the winemaker, one of the winemakers' winemaker. It's a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason because it has reality to it. But for a lot of people that don't know, what was it about Rhone varieties, you know, the Syrah, Grenache, Mourvèdre, what was it about those grapes that and the white ones as well? What was it that attracted you?
Well, what attracted me was the desire for success and the fear of failure. That was the main attraction, frankly, because I wanted to be in the wine business, and Pinot was not going anywhere, and I knew I needed to do something, and I needed to do something different. I didn't want to make the same wine that everyone else did, even back then. I was lucky enough to get to spend some time with Kermit Lynch back before he was Kermit Lynch. He had a little wine shop in Albany, California, and he was there by himself listening to records. In the day, nobody ever came into his store. Few people came into his store. I don't think I ever saw very many people ever come in. But Kermit got me interested in Rhone varieties, and I had the sort of intuition, not really the knowledge, but really the intuition that maybe the varieties of Southern France could do well in California. Now, of course, it's quite obvious that they would, but back then it wasn't as obvious. And you know, the other thing, I couldn't articulate this at the time, but again, I had the intuition, I'm not sure where it came from, that, you know, probably the Rhone varieties we were growing in California, probably none of them were exactly perfect. None of them were exactly grown either in the right place or in exactly the right way. But perhaps by blending them together, one could compensate for the individual deficits and still make an interesting wine. And this is actually a reasonable strategy. This makes actually a lot of sense. Monocepage wines more challenging then and now, and monocepage wines are still very difficult to achieve elegance with in a warm or dry climate. In a warm, dry climate, you don't have the same fine articulation of flavor that you have in a cooler, milder climate with higher acidity. When you have lower alcohol, higher acidity, everything kind of pops a little bit more distinctly, and you can create a little more nuance, which is not to say that cool climate grapes are necessarily, well, they are possibly intrinsically, potentially more interesting than warm climate ones. Warm climate just you have to develop a different strategy for achieving complexity, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I want to go back to that. I don't want to go on to blending, but I want to ask you a little bit about Kermit Lynch, only because, you know, I've been to his store. I worked briefly for a consignment company where one of our big portfolio was based around Kermit Lynch. I've read his book. I started loving Bandole because of him and so many other, you know, wines. I'm curious what was Kermit Lynch like back then? This is a really wine nerdy question. I apologize to some of the people listening, but I need to know just what your impressions were of Kermit Lynch. Because for people listening, he, you know, had a really big influence on people consuming French wines here in North America.
Well, Kermit Lynch then was the same as Kermit Lynch now, which is to say, strangely, the most unexpected wine merchant. He's very shy. Not a people person. He kind of complains a lot about having to live in France and like go out for, you know, eat all those, that rich French food. Aww. You know, he's got the perfect leg. Come on, Kermit, for God's sake. You know, he has to, you know, just drink all these wines and eat all this food. I mean, my God, you know, what life is brutal.
Poor son of a bitch. He's got to try off the beat Bordeaux while having duck confit. That's a tough Tuesday.
Kermit is a passionate wine man. I owe a great debt of gratitude to him.
Your skills as a blender, because you're mentioning just about, you know, blending these varieties depending on vintage and all of that. How much did that change over the years from when you first started with Bonny Doon?
I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, one is not really aware of the fact you're gaining skills because it happens slowly over time. But this is actually the one thing I'm good at. This is maybe the only thing I'm really good at, is blending wines together. I'm pretty good at it. And I don't even know exactly where it comes from, but it's a skill. And somehow I've got it. I think I can't even really describe my methodology except kind of retrospectively. I will say one thing. I'm humbled by the fact that knowledge or skill or whatever it is not necessarily 100% explainable or rational. I think truly so much comes from intuition. And in many respects, I was more successful as a young winemaker than as an old winemaker, or maybe as a young winemaker and an old winemaker, I've been reasonably successful in the middle, less so. But I made some very good wines back when I understood nothing, not a single thing. And I was operating on it just from a different level, just a level of intuition or connectedness or something that mystical. And I would love to try to cultivate that, to find that quality. I mean, that seems very, very important. Inspiration seems very, very important. It's not just technical mastery.
Yeah, it's part science, part art, part intuition, and just part skill. You know, you remind me of a little bit, Randall, and I'm sure you get this all the time. You remind me of Eddie Murphy. And by that, everyone can say they're funny. Everyone can make people laugh at the office party. But the truly gifted ones, it's just sort of there. And it's sometimes hard to explain. And I always felt that way with Eddie Murphy. He probably felt that way. Just, you know, a young guy exploded on the scene. And, you know, you can't replicate it. Just the really funny people, you're either funny or you're not.
Yep.
Were you nervous? Were you nervous back in the 80s? Because, you know, at the time, those wines weren't as well known as they are now. It was a Cabernet, Chardonnay sort of life. I'm just speaking economically from a, you know, from a purely just trying to get by, make a buck point of view. Were you nervous deciding to go the Rhone route?
Well, I kind of figured out, I believed fairly early on that I was on the right track. The first wine amazingly came out well. And, you know, in retrospect, I'm aware of how easily it could have not turned out well. It could easily have taken a sideways turn, but it didn't. It worked out well. So as I've sometimes said, it's been a matter of intermittent positive reinforcement. In other words, it's worked well enough of the time that I've kept doing it. And then, of course, I was very lucky to have some commercial acknowledgement. I was, you know, that magazine, what do they call it, the Wine Spectator. I was on the cover of that in 1989. That actually kind of helped.
I was going to go there next. What was that day like? I've been doing all these big picture questions, so let's just drill down and go super specific. What was the photo shoot like with you posing as a masked man for the April 1989 Wine Spectator cover, posing for the Lone Ranger piece?
Well, the strange thing is they didn't tell me that I was going to be on the cover. They said, we're doing a story about you. This was actually the second story that they had done a smaller story on me. Mort Hochstein had done a story on me a couple of years previous. So they said, you know, we're doing a story on you. We want to take your picture. Would you mind bringing a horse to the vineyard?
What?
Right. They said, would you just mind bringing a horse?
They asked you to bring a horse?
They must have told me a white horse. But they said, you know, we just need a horse. My neighbor luckily had a white horse, as it turned out. So it was not a big deal to find a horse. Although we had to take some shoe polish because the horse had a little spot on her forehead. So we had to put some shoe polish over it. Anyways, after the magazine came out, it was kind of an explosion. There was a lot of pent up demand for new things. And I got calls from having like three distributors in the country, I suddenly now had 25 or 30. So things happened pretty quickly. And of course I was very, if somebody said, we'd like to buy your wine, I would say, sure, of course. I didn't really do such a great diligent job of vetting wholesalers back in the day, but I did end up with some good ones by accident.
I'm going to go back to the comedy metaphor for a second. Comedians always said that once they went on Johnny Carson for the first time, that's when their careers exploded. You do Johnny Carson, the next day their agent would get 100 calls. Did Wine Spectator, especially back in the late 80s when there was no internet, so the Wine Spectator was one of these giant gatekeepers for popularity. Was it kind of the same sort of thing with that magazine?
Exactly the same. Yes. Yeah. You know, I even got a call from Angelo Gaia, strangely enough, who imported the wines to Italy. He couldn't sell them to save his life, strangely enough. So he ended up drinking it all himself. He loves Bonnie Doon wines, but he had to drink pretty much the whole consignment.
Did that make you feel good or bad? Bad that he couldn't sell it, or good that someone like Gaia loved your wines and you know that he was guzzling back your Grenache?
Both. It was mixed emotions.
God, that would be. How was your funeral for Corks? Did it get good attendance?
It got good attendance and it got good publicity. It was another PR explosion. It was, dare I say, it was a masterstroke. It was a coup de théâtre. It was extraordinary. It was one of the great, I mean, fortunately or unfortunately, it was a marketing, spectacular marketing event, which I think was great in many respects, but it also kind of, I think, has marked me as being potentially more of a marketer than actually a winemaker, to my chagrin. So I think, as I sometimes say, he who lives by marketing dies by marketing. So
which,
if you overmarket yourself, if you're overly successful, I think it can potentially detract from the gravitas, the perception of gravitas of what you're doing.
Well, considering, you know, 2006, when you sold, you know, Big House Wines and Cardinal Zinn, people would realize you're not about the marketing. But I'm a bad host because people listening might not know the story. Randall, if you could tell everyone about that funeral for Corks.
Right.
Yeah.
So in other words, here's what happened. If you remember back then in those dark days, the quality of Corks was abysmal, truly abysmal. I mean, disaster, really disastrous. Everybody knew it. Everybody complained about it, but nobody felt they could do anything. The wine writers were unhappy. The sommeliers were unhappy. Everybody was unhappy. The connoisseurs were unhappy. I was really unhappy. I adopted what were called Supreme Corks, which were a synthetic closure. And I did that for a few years.
What years was this, by the way? Sorry to interrupt. What years was this?
The late 1990s. So this is 97, 98, 96, 97, 98, 99.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Corks worked okay for wines that were going to be consumed within 2 or 3 or 4 years. No big deal. But for Vin de Garde, they were not really appropriate because they led to a premature oxidation. And they were also difficult to extract. And they were kind of, they had their own set of problems, which were kind of comparable to different, but as bad as corks in their own way. So corks weren't working. Supreme Corks weren't working for me. There was really no alternative but screw caps. And in doing research about screw caps, I learned that they had been around for a while. They'd been studied for quite a while. And from a technical standpoint, they were a perfectly acceptable closure. The only issue was commercial acceptance and the belief, rightly or wrongly, that the public was not ready to embrace screw caps. So I thought to myself, rather overconfidently, well, we'll just change perception. We'll just fix that. We'll just fix that. So what we need to do, this is an opportunity. This is not a challenge. This is an opportunity. We can change people's perceptions. We just need to do something really big and really outrageous. So we did. You know, I remember my sales manager saying to me, Randall, he said, you know, let's do a test. Let's test this in Ohio. You know, let's do screw caps in Ohio. And I told him, you know, that's not going to do anything. That's just Ohio. And we're not going to sell, we might sell a little bit of wine in Ohio, maybe not. But if we do something on a larger scale, it's an opportunity to really make a statement and really get some exposure. So we went big. We went big. And I was lucky enough, and I still can't believe she did it. I persuaded Jancis Robinson to come to New York and deliver the eulogy for Monsieur Thierry Bouchon.
I did not know. Oh, my God, that's fantastic.
And we had a funeral procession. We had an antique hearse with a coffin and a corpse made out of corks. And we staged a proper wake for Monsieur Bouchon. We staged a black dinner a la Huisman, a rebours, with just black food. And it was quite an event. And we got a lot of an amazing amount of press coverage. They still write about this. I don't know if they still write about it, but for many years they wrote about this.
Good for Jancis. I remember when I was going for my diploma graduation ceremony in London, England. She was there and just so unassuming. My girlfriend could not understand why I didn't have the guts to go and talk to her. Because I'm like, oh, I don't want to bug her. Other people are bugging. I don't want. And she's like, what? You mean that little woman standing over there? I'm like, that woman's Jancis Robinson. And like, I just didn't have the courage to go up and talk to her. That's great. She did that for your funeral.
Yes, it was amazing. Yeah, the first time I met Jancis was in Contra Costa County in Antioch, California. And I took her to lunch. The only place they had to eat was McDonald's. So my first date with Jancis was at a McDonald's where we had a fillet of fish sandwich. That was my introduction to Jancis.
What did you pair with it? I've often thought that Ontario Gamay goes really well with a Big Mac. The acid really cuts through. What wine did you serve with a fillet of fish?
I don't even remember at this point. But I don't.
So, nerdy wine question for you. More important for you as a winemaker, getting the expression of the varietal or getting the expression of the terroir? They're obviously both important, but if you have to lean in one direction, the expression of the grape or the expression of the land?
I think the expression of the terroir trumps the expression of the variety. In fact, one could even argue that the variety, as long as it's within certain gross parameters, the variety that you use in a great terroir, it may not even matter so much what particular grape you're growing, as long as you're kind of more or less within the lines. But I think a great site will produce great wine with a whole range of different grape varieties. So I definitely come down on the side of terroir.
The important, yeah. So then, the importance of somewhere versus anywhere, I guess, sort of relates to that.
Well, I think the somewhereness, I mean, you can think about terroir a lot of ways, but in some by definition, every site has terroir. If every place has a quality of place. Not all places are as articulate in their distinctiveness of place. You know, some people talk loudly, some people talk very quietly. So some terroirs are very quiet and very discreet. Others are more profound and more evident. But a wine that has a strong sense of terroir, for me, is a more complex wine, a more interesting wine, a more nuanced wine, and ultimately the wine that I want to come back to. Whereas a wine that's just a technically well-made wine, that just is a technical expression of the grape, has a certain, if you will, flatness to it, or less dimensionality, more two-dimensional than three-dimensional.
How do you feel when you see people in the wine world, like smart people on all different sides, arguing just about the idea of terroir?
Well, I mean, I don't know. You know, life is too short, so I don't know. life is too short. Let them argue. Let them beat their brains out. I mean, I got to go. I got work to do, so let them argue, for God's sake.
Love it. You know what? That's a great answer. My girlfriends sometimes wonder why I don't take most things personally. I'm like, I do with you and maybe 9 other people. Beyond that, leaf in the river. Randall, how much does your accountant hate you? I love this quote: to make great wine, one must throw away the idea of making a profit. And then in 2006, you unloaded, I think, Big House Wines and Cardinals Inn to focus more on Bonnie Doon. So how much does your accountant hate you?
A lot.
Ah!
But again, the accountant, it's not the accountant that hates me, it's the banker who hates me. I am not a financial whiz at all, which is kind of the understatement of the century. I'm fiscally challenged. Numbers, spreadsheets, all those things just make my head spin and make me dizzy. So what I really need is a great business partner who's a lot more clever than I am in keeping track of these things. But I still believe that great wine is not really a particularly remunerative pursuit. I think it's you either want to make money or you want to make great wine, but I don't know that you want to do both or can do both. Rare to do both.
Why is that, to be able for those two worlds not to coexist?
Because you're a perfectionist. Because if you're really serious about making great wine, it can never, there's never too much detail to look at, to consider. You can always make it better. You can always refine, and all these things, everything that equals refinement equals R&D, experimentation and risk of failure. So you're always risking failure, and you're pushing the limit, and getting these incremental increases in quality do not necessarily equate to your ability to charge, to recoup the costs of doing so.
What's the happiest you've ever been about one of your wines, one of your vintages? I get the sense that, and you're not alone in this, being a perfectionist, that's a hard burden to carry. Do you have a year, a certain blend, just a wine where you're like, yeah, I really nailed this one?
Yeah. There have been a couple that I've felt they really nailed in a sense, but again, I'm humbled by one in particular comes to mind. Years ago, we made a wine called Le Sophiste from the vineyard in Santa Cruz Mountains in Bonnie Doon. And I originally had planted it to Pinot Noir, and then I was unhappy with the Pinot Noir. I grafted it over to Marsan, Roussan, and Syrah. Well, so it turns out, the Roussan that I had grafted wasn't really Roussan. It turned out to be something else. It turned out to actually be Viognier. But I made the wine. It was I don't know if you ever saw it, or it had a funny presentation. It was came with a top hat. It was a tall bottle with a top hat, and it was distinctive wine. And it was sort of the first wine that I really sort of conceived of from scratch. I mean, I thought about, well, new grapes never grown before in California, or seldom grown in California, Marsanne and Roussanne, and certainly not grown in the last 7,500 years. And new way of making the wine, and the wine came out great. And not only did it come out great, but I had a bottle of it recently. Now it's been 25 years after the vintage. The wine is still delicious, still amazing. Now, this isn't supposed to happen. Viognier is not supposed to age. I was growing the wrong grapes under misconception. And so all these crazy things that shouldn't have happened, happened. But that's the wine business, or that's wine. Wine is just full of surprises.
That's a good story. Yeah, I can see how that would make you happy to drink that. I'd love to hear more about the changes in your wine. 2018, no more Mourvèdre. It's now Grenache, a small amount of Syrah with Cinsault. I'm curious about this change in the wine blending.
Well, for one thing, I sold the company. I mean, that was
going to be next. I was going to get into that next, but
yeah, I mean, but so in 2018, I mean, this is one of my disappointments in life. I felt that in the last recent years and the recent vintages, well, basically since the 21st century, cigar has kind of turned the corner and been wonderful wine from 2001, 2003 onward. Has been real 2005, great vintage. And the last several vintages, 2015, 16, and 17, are arguably the best cigars I ever made. The problem, of course, is I still, over the years, never figured out how to sell cigar. And part of the problem has been, frankly, some of the very influential wine publications that will remain nameless, Wine Spectator and Parker, never really understood kind of elegant, the virtue of an elegant style Rhone blend. I mean, they understood Rhone blends that are heavily extracted, that are kind of more in the model of an actual Châteauneuf du Pape or an Hermitage, but elegant wines, not so much. So we never really got the great scores for Cigar Volant, which is kind of an understatement. So we've had a following for the wine, but the collectors, the people who are willing to spend a lot of money for that style of wine, just the market for that just never really developed. So it's kind of ironic that the best cigars that I ever made, we really couldn't sell for the price that I needed to sell them for to make it work. So I bit the bullet and changed the style and decided, you know what, I'm going to live to fight another day. This is not the hill I want to die on. So we'll sell cigar at a different price point, sell a bunch of it, change the style, make it more economically, have the wine be more presentable for release when it's younger. So we used to hold the wine for 5 or 6 years prior to release. Again, economically,
which is rare.
Pretty rude. And then
that's rare in California.
We held it forever, and then we would discount it to sell it by the glass and for restaurant pricing. So between holding the wine forever and then discounting it, the economics just didn't work. So the new style is delicious. It's not the same as the old style, but it's delicious. It's not going to live quite as long as the old style. It's still going to live quite a while. It's fresher, higher in acid, doesn't see any oak, fruitier, more approachable, softer. So it's nice. It's lovely wine.
And for people that don't know, and again, I'm a bad host. I just always assume everyone knows. I mean, it's sort of what you were known for, Le Cigar Volant, which before was your classic GSM, Grenache, Syrah, Mourvèdre. But you dropped the Mourvèdre, added the Cinsault just for that more freshness, more acidity. What is it, do you think, about major American publications that have sometimes a hard time with the idea of elegance?
Well, I think it has to do with several things. One is consistency. And say what you will about Parker or the Spectator for that matter, I think it's an easier case to make if you're stylistically consistent. So in other words, it's a lot easier to if there's a certain style of wine, you call it extracted, robust, powerful. You know, if you can identify those wines and your recommendations are always consistently within those parameters, your customers, your readers know exactly what to expect. So people who like Parker wines are never disappointed in a Parker recommendation because they're incredibly consistent. The fact is, in real life, we as human beings are eclectic in our tastes, and there's all kinds of great wines. There are great wines that are heavily extracted, and there are great wines that are elegant. They're all great wines, but it's more difficult to make the case for that with this certain kind of public, a certain kind of reader. They want a certain stylistic consistency. So towing the line or hewing the line with stylistic consistency is just an easier case to make. I think that's the main reason. And it's also just easier. Those wines are easier to identify. Elegant wines, you know, take more time and attention and study, and you have to taste them over and over again, and that's tedious and hard work. Whereas a powerful blockbuster wine, you know it in a second. So from an efficiency standpoint, it's easier to identify, and it's also, as I said, more consistent. So that it's just people taking the path of least resistance.
Yeah, no, that's a great point.
If you're someone like Jancis, who has so much credibility, Jancis could rave about elegant wines, and she could rave about powerful wines, and people will follow and listen to what she says. But that's very rare to have that kind of credibility, I think.
Yeah, I think the important thing for wine drinkers is I'm fine with consistency, because not every wine experience is supposed to be this thinking, let's really dig into what's going on here. Sometimes you just want the consistent, your filet-o-fish of wine. But the other side is the beautiful thing, like going back to Burgundy, is like you'll go to a Burgundy tasting, same vineyard, same plot, two different vintages, and they taste completely different. And that if I could just distill it to the simplest point, that right there is the coolest thing about wine. It's the same land, the same people making it, and it tastes so different. That's the wonderful thing about wine.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
But, you know, Americans or North Americans, forgive me, we like consistent. We're not crazy about big surprises. We're not crazy about vintage variation. We generally like, if it tastes one way on a Sunday, we want it to taste the same way on Wednesday.
Yeah.
Or similar.
I just think it's all about just balance. Listen, on Tuesday and Wednesday, my guilty pleasure is slightly overly oaked California Chardonnay, that's $17 to $22.95 a bottle. But Thursday through Sunday, I'm just going to want something that challenges a little bit more. It's just, it's all about just, a little bit of variety in life.
Yep.
Before we get to your sale, I forgot. And by the way, Randall, I appreciate you taking the time. We're now a little bit heavy. I said 30 minutes. I lied. I was going to try to keep you on here for longer than 30 minutes. you were on Oprah back in 2009. What was that? By the way, this is an audio podcast, but Randall's laughing now. What was that like?
Well, in a sense, slightly disappointing, because I think I'm the only person who's never received a proper Oprah bounce. So we did, alas, I was hoping for the Oprah bounce, but we tasted wine. It was a goofy thing. It was with, what the heck was it? There was wine. It was wine tasting on an airplane. I think it was Virgin Air was doing a wine taste. We were doing a simultaneous wine tasting, and it was some kind of, this was not Zoom. Zoom hadn't been invented then.
No, but
it was some, whatever the Zoom analog was back then. So it was a simultaneous wine tasting in three or four different locations. And I remember we tasted we made Albarino at the time. And Oprah, I think, was very tired, or she had just come in from someplace. But she was really enjoying the oak character of the Albarino. Of course, there was no oak character in the Albarino.
You didn't tell her that, right? You kept that to yourself.
I almost tried to tell her, but then I kind of chicken. You know, it's like whatever.
I can't believe you didn't get the Oprah bounce. Everyone gets the Oprah bounce.
Didn't get the Oprah bounce.
Hold on. Wait a minute. I gotta circle back. What is tougher for you to deal with? The fact you never got the Oprah bounce, or that Gaia couldn't sell your wine?
Probably not getting the Oprah bounce. I mean, I could have used the Oprah bounce back then. I mean, I could still use the Oprah
bounce. We could all use it.
We could all use the Oprah bounce.
As we're coming to a conclusion of this pod, I was wondering the sale in January of 2020, the motivation behind that to, I think it was War Room Ventures LLC. I know nothing about business. I don't even know what LLC stands for. But the motivation behind the sale and what your role now is with Bonnie Doon, because I first heard about it, I'm like, oh no, Randall's gone. What's going on? But just to everyone out there, what's the motivation and where are you now?
What's my motivation here? Motivation is really to kind of focus on smaller projects. And I have a vineyard in San Juan Bautista, which is a very dear project for me. And I just kind of, in the words of Steve Martin, want to get small again, if you will, and focused. And, you know, I don't have that many productive years left. So I want them to count. And I want them to really, really focus on things that are of more deeper meaning to me. So that's my motivation. Mm-hmm. So I'm still working with War Room, with Bonnie Doon. I'm still consulting on the blending. I'm not so much in the day-to-day activities, but still got my hand in.
And as we end this, we were talking before, is there a chance beyond me ordering it to my folks' place in Florida and then sneaking home four bottles at a time whenever Canadians can travel again? Getting Bonnie Doon wines in Ontario. Is that something that we'll see anytime soon? Happening.
What's that? We'll see it soon. I believe the order is already en route. It's coming.
That is fantastic. Because as I said off the top, after that my first California wine tasting, it might have been at least a decade ago now. It should probably be longer. No one knows anything about time. Every time I would go to the California wine tasting at the Royal York Hotel, everyone would be packed at the Silver Oaks. And I always walked in. My first thing was the same thing. Where I would go look at the giant map. I'm like, where's Bonnie Doon? I need to go there first. I'm telling this to the listeners. These are special wines. These are unique wines. These are different wines. And they're a hell of a testament to a great winemaker. And Randall, I really appreciate being on the pod. This has been a real thrill for me.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.